Thank you very much, Olga. I would like to thank you all for this invitation, and I'm very happy to be at Perimeter, even from a distance. And today, we'll talk about the Euclidean wormholes as interacting systems. And this is a work done in collaboration with Elias Kiritsis and Olga. It is based on these two references and some work in progress. So first of all, let me try to give some motivation behind why studying Euclidean wormholes. Okay, of course, these are interesting exotic solutions of general relativity plus matter, but our motivation is mainly to understand holography in the presence of multiple boundaries, more than one boundaries, and in particular, whether there are some universal properties of the dual quantum field theory description of such geometries. Moreover, we'd like also to understand if there is any microscopic model that essentially can describe such geometries, and if we can describe and understand string theory essentially on target space wormhole backgrounds. Before beginning the talk, I would like to make a clear distinction between Lorentzian and Euclidean wormholes. I will describe soon why these are very different and their physical properties are very different. And in addition, even if we focus only on Euclidean wormholes, there is a further distinction between macroscopic or microscopic wormholes, or what is colloquially called the gas of wormholes, or the alpha parameter story of Coleman. And this is because these have very different characteristic scales. In the first case, we describe solutions that for which the wormhole scale is much larger than the Planck scale or the string scale, and it could be close to the ADS scale. But in this microscopic gas of wormholes, the wormholes typically are thought to be very microscopic, and they might approach the string scale or the Planck scale. So the plan of the talk is first to give a review of some things that are already known. And in the first main part, I will describe a bulk gravitational perspective on these solutions. And in the second part, I will describe some free theoretic models that can reproduce some behavior of some observables. And in the end, I will summarize and conclude with some future directions. So let me first start with something that is better known, I hope to a lot of people, the story of Lorentzian wormholes, or what is colloquially called the ER equals EPR story. So here I draw the eternal black hole on ADS. This geometry has two exteriors, the left and the right exterior, and also a future interior and the past interior, with these lines at 45 degrees denote the horizons that essentially separate the two exteriors. Now, if we take a slice on this geometry at t equals zero, this slice here, essentially the topology of this slice is the so-called Einstein-Rosen bridge, which is a form of wormhole that essentially connects the left with the right exterior. More recently, in the context of holography, it was understood that this wormhole essentially describes the EPR pair, or the Einstein-Podolsky-Rosen pair, of two black holes in a particular entangled state of two non-interacting quantum field theories. And this state is the state that I write down here, which is the so-called thermofield double state. It was understood then from these works, mainly from Maldacena, that large amounts of entanglement can actually give rise to a geometric connection. So that's one way of getting wormholes in the Lorentzian context. Now, a few more comments about the Lorentzian wormholes. As we said before, this geometry we interpret it as describing a pair of decoupled but entangled quantum field theories. And in particular, we cannot communicate a message between the two sides because the two boundaries are always separated by horizon once the null energy condition is satisfied for the bulk gravitational theory. In addition, if we analytically continue this geometry to Euclidean signature, essentially the geometry becomes that of two decoupled cigars, and the space smoothly caps off, disconnecting the different asymptotic boundaries. So perhaps you've seen this picture already, but the geometry becomes this type. So in the Euclidean signature, the geometry is essentially decoupled and there is no connection. More colloquially, we can say that the entanglement cannot keep the Euclidean space connected. More recent advances have to do with traversable wormholes, which are Lorentzian signature solutions again, for which the null energy condition is violated so that signals can pass from the one side of the wormhole to the other. And this is achieved essentially by introducing local interactions that essentially couple the two boundary theories. So this was more or less what I wanted to say about Lorentzian wormholes, but let's now move on to the case of Euclidean wormholes, for which entanglement is not enough. Now, these Euclidean wormholes are not slices of Lorentzian manifolds. They should be thought of directly in the Euclidean context. So these are space-time more properly called space wormholes because we are in Euclidean signature and could be thought of analogous to the instantons of gauge theories. Now, it's actually hard to get such solutions in pure Einstein gravity. You cannot get them because one needs some locally negative Euclidean energy, essentially near this throat region, to support it from collapsing, because typically these geometries would like to pinch off into two disconnected geometries. Fortunately, in Euclidean signature, this can be done and provided by other matter fields, such as axions or some fluxes that can support essentially this throat. Now, some preliminary holographic comments that we also had in our first work is that, as we said before, since we have a geometric connection in Euclidean signature, entanglement is irrelevant and is not enough to describe this connection. Moreover, we can think of global symmetries for, so we can think of having two boundary theories, QFTs living on the two boundaries, and we can consider global symmetries for these boundary theories. At least naively, one might say, okay, there is one conserved current for the first boundary theory and another conserved current for the second boundary theory, and they're totally unrelated. But we know from holography that for each conserved current, there is a bulk gauge field. And in particular, there's a common bulk gas law constraint that connects essentially the two theories. This also goes to other observables. For example, if we had different quantum field theories on the different boundaries, we could consider cross-correlators, as I will soon describe. And if they are completely decoupled, one might say, okay, all these cross-correlations should essentially factorize all these cross-correlators. But on the other hand, if we have a common bulk, we expect some form of cross-correlation, so some form of interaction. So how can this be? So this is related also to an old problem known from 2004 by Maldacena and Maus, the so-called factorization problem. This is the problem. This problem is described in the following way. So imagine that we have two quantum field theories on the two boundaries, and we try to compute the partition function, let's say, of the system. So if we see it from a field theory perspective, if these are totally decoupled, the partition function should factorize into the product of partition functions. On the other hand, if we compute this using gravity, essentially we might find some disconnected saddles, but we could also find these wormholes. So essentially, effectively, we find that the partition function does not factorize anymore. So this is a problem. And there are many, let's say, proposals towards its resolution. I'm not against, and we can discuss these proposals more in the end. I will describe a somewhat different proposal, but it's nice to state all of these to have them in mind. One first possibility that arose from studying lower dimensional examples is that the bulk quantum gravity path integral essentially corresponds to an average over quantum field theories. So essentially, even though for a single member of an ensemble of quantum field theories, the partition function would factorize, essentially one needs to perform an average. So that correlates essentially the partition function. But of course, this raises the questions, do we ever do ever what and how in practice? And in particular, in higher dimensions, it's hard to find a useful notion of average in higher dimension. Also, it is at class with the usual notion of unitarity, and that class with a canonical example that we all know and we have studied to death with integrability techniques also, and works very, very nice. The example of n equals 4 super Young Mills and type 2B string theory. Other works advocated an approximate statistical type of averaging that is based essentially on ideas related to the eigenstate thermalization hypothesis or chaos. In that perspective, we might view these wormholes as some kind of statistical effective wormholes. And since this hypothesis is typically working for high energy states that approximate the thermal ensemble, other recent work motivates that these geometries should appear above the black hole threshold. So when we study observables that are affected essentially from high energy states, for example, the recent work of Witten. Another proposal is that, we computed, let's say, if you see here this expansion, we essentially computed only the first, let's say, two terms of an expansion, and we should actually sum over all possible bulk topologies and even other non-perturbative states, such as D-brains, et cetera, And once we do this complete sum, the correlators in the end would found to be to factorize and the partition functions to factorize. Of course, this is really, really hard to check, and we actually need some non-perturbative information to actually do this computation. So these are some, I don't know if you have any question about these proposals already. Feel free to ask me any questions at any question at any time. I cannot see if you raise your hand, so just unmute yourselves and ask a question. Okay. So the straightforward resolution that we will propose is that essentially we could have direct, not direct, some form of interactions between these quantum field theories. But as we will soon see, these interactions should have very subtle properties. And in particular, you might say, okay, how come a pair of two boundaries and not single, a single one? Why the system of quantum field theories is actually living on two separate boundaries and not on on the same boundary, let's say. We will try to motivate that in such systems, the partition function takes this the following form. So this is a kind of average of partition functions or Schwinger functions of each quantum field theory, where we have an extra label S that labels some kind of sector. We will describe what the sector means, but we also need to find such a form for the partition function in a unitary setting without doing any kind of additional average. Okay. And we will also see that in such a case, any cross correlator can also be computed as an average of lower point correlators. So I think that's a nice, good place to stop. If there is any question, please interrupt me now. But then we will continue with the bulk perspective of the problem. Okay. So if there is no question, I will continue. So in our first work, we studied various kinds of solutions, and it was a bottom-up study. So I don't think it's so important to list all the types of solutions that we found, because from then, there are people found many, many more such solutions. What is important to say is that there was also a recent paper where stability of such solutions was studied. And in that paper, it was found that at least a subset of such solutions are perturbatively stable. So in contrary to some older work from other authors that was claiming that we should disregard these solutions completely, we should actually take this solution seriously and understand their physics. On the other hand, it's also important to say that at least to my knowledge, there is no such solution that is cleanly embedded in string theory, in 10-dimensional or 11-dimensional. String theory, and this is actually a very interesting problem for the future to be tackled. Okay, so in our first work, apart from studying solutions, we said, okay, let's try to understand the basic physics. So let's try to study some observables of local and non-local operators. So we should study correlation functions to unravel their physics. The first thing that one can try to do is to study correlators for local boundary operators. We'll denote them by O1, the operators that are inserted in the theory in the boundary one, and O2, the ones that are inserted in the second theory. And it is possible to do so in gravity by studying the bulk fluctuation equation for the dual field. If these operators are scalars, then the dual field is a scalar. Now, since we have two boundaries, we have two places where we can insert operators or sources. And this extra freedom provides for two types of correlation functions. Correlation functions with insertions on the same boundary or on the second boundary, or even cross correlators. And the simplest two-point function is a two-point function where we insert one operator on the first boundary and another on the second boundary. Now, for Euclidean EDS2, it was possible to compute such correlators analytically. And in other cases, we have some partial analytic and partial numerical results. Now, okay, I don't want to bore you with a detailed prescription. You can ask me after the end of the talk how you actually compute these correlators. But let me focus now on the universal properties that we found that the scalar correlators obey. In this left plot, I plot the correlate the 1-1 or the 2-2 correlator as a function of momentum k, and on the right plot I plot the cross correlator, the 1-2 correlator, again as a function of momentum k. Now we observe that the correlators on a single boundary have a similar behavior in the UV for large k, as in the case where we have only a single boundary. So we have the usual power law divergence. Now, in the infrared, it was found that they saturate to a constant positive value. On the other hand, the cross-correlator has exactly the opposite behavior. It goes quickly to zero in the UV, so for large case, and it has a finite maximum in the infrared. Now, it is for Euclidean this two, it is actually possible to Fourier transform these correlators and have them in position space as well. And the correlators O101 behave in this fashion, the usual way that we might expect. But the cross-correlator takes this form, and we observe that there is no short-distance singularity for the cross-correlator. In some sense, you can understand that because the boundary points are, in some sense, separate, right? The one can never fall on top of the other. Now, okay, here I plot some continuous functions. Of course, if the transverse space is, let's say, a sphere, you could have a discrete spectrum, so you would find some discrete dots here in these plots instead. But if you connect all these dots, essentially you find again the same qualitative behavior. So the qualitative behavior of the correlators that we studied in the various examples is the same for all these types of solutions that we studied, at least for scalar correlators. So there is some kind of universality in these results that I think is quite important. Okay. So these were the results about local observables, but we also moved forward to understand non-local observables such as Wilson loops. Now, in order to study in holography such observables, we know that we need essentially to minimize a string wall sheet that tends on the corresponding loop on the boundary and minimize essentially tail. Now, the simplest observable is we compute the expectation value of a single Wilson loop placed on one of the two boundaries. Now, what we can tune is essentially the size of the loop. And in the limit of a larger loop, we find that the dual surface penetrates further in the bulk. So essentially, we probe the infrared properties of the boundary dual, whatever this is. We found also that this boundary surface can never, this bulk surface, wall sheet surface, can never pass through the middle of the throat. Now, here are some properties. So here in this graph, I plot the regularized axion as a function of a parameter T star, where this T star should be thought of as an angular parameter that describes essentially the size of the loop. So in the previous picture, we were placing the geometry of the boundary was just a free sphere, for example. And essentially, this T star governs where exactly the loop is sitting on the free sphere. Now, we also have three different plots for different cases, how big the throat of the wormhole is compared to the ADS scale. Now, in these plots, you see that for large loop, in all these cases, the axion starts to scale approximately linearly with this star. And if you compute the area, essentially you find that this scaling is actually an area law for the loop. Now, in the case where we have just a single boundary, it was understood by Witten early enough that this area law is indicative of an infrared confining behavior, but only if we take the infinite volume limit of the free sphere, because otherwise confinement is essentially kinematical and trivial. Here, the situation is more subtle because we have two asymptotic boundaries, so the arguments are not exactly the same. In particular, we can move forward and study a further observable, that is a loop-loop correlator, where we place two loops, one loop on one boundary and another loop on the second boundary. And we find a phase transition between a single surface that connects the two loops that is drawn here and two disconnected surfaces that, that is the case that is drawn here. Now, when the loops are small, the leading configuration is the configuration below, while when the loops are large, the leading configuration is the one above. In the second case, the loops can only interact through the exchange of bulk perturbative modes that, as I have drawn here. So we analyzed also this loop cross-correlator, and we found essentially that for large loops, we have a strong infrared cross-coupling. And we termed this behavior a sort of cross-confining behavior, also consistent with the results that we found for local correlation functions. So that were the results in quantum field in gravity. So if you have any question, please stop me here. about these results. Otherwise, I will move forward to the quantum field theory models. Okay, so if there are no questions, I will start describing the universal properties of the putative dual. Now, for Lorentzian traversable wormholes, it is possible to couple the two boundary CFTs, as we said, by double trace deformation that was described by Gauss-Jaffe wall that takes this form. So this is a local interaction term that couples essentially the two theories. Now, in the Euclidean case, we found a different behavior. We found that the cross interactions are very soft at short distances, but then they increase and become strong in the infrared and have this sort of cross-confining behavior. So the two theories should interact very mildly in the UV, and the mixed correlator should not have any short distance singularities. Now, it is not possible to have such a behavior by introducing such a direct local interaction term. So our initial bottom-up proposal was the following: to take two Euclidean theories and a set of local operators for each one and introduce effective non-local cross interactions, where this function f is a kernel whose properties we determined in order to match, let's say, the gravitational results. Of course, this proposal has some defects, and the main problem is that essentially it's an inherently non-local proposal. It is not possible to integrate a d-dimensional field to make this look local, as we found. And also, since these wormholes affect any operator that you can imagine that you introduce on the boundary, essentially you need an infinite sum here. And also you need to get rid of the 1 over n suppression that essentially that typically follows when you consider double trace deformations. So there are some inherent, let's say, problems with this proposal. And more recently, Van Aramstong and in our recent paper, we found a way to improve on that proposal and get rid of these deficiencies. So the class of models resolving these issues is the following. We take a system of two d-dimensional holographic BQFTs, and we couple them through a d plus one dimensional messenger theory. We call it messenger theory. Now, normally, such a system would be dual to a d plus two dimensional gravitational theory in the presence of end of the world brains, where the geometry stops. The idea then was to consider a system for which the central charge of the d plus one quantum theory is much, much smaller than the central charge of the d-dimensional BQFTs. And we also argued that the system should also float a gap confining theory in the infrared. So the idea then is that this end of the world brains would bend and essentially connect in the infrared. Now, in our recent work, we studied an extreme, let's say, limit of this construction, where the messenger theory, this d plus one theory, is essentially quasi-topological. So in that case, we won't expect any local excitations to propagate in d plus two dimensions. So let me give you a simple model where we were able to essentially solve it completely in two dimensions and one dimension. So let me draw again a small picture of this case because it's so simple. So we take a two-dimensional system and two one-dimensional systems. The coordinates that we will use is the coordinate zeta and the coordinate, let's call the other coordinate tau. So we place two matrix quantum mechanics. So MQM1 is placed here, MQM2 is placed here. And these are one-dimensional models. And we also put here a quasi-topological theory, so a two-dimensional BF type of theory, propagating essentially on this trip. So we put the endpoints of the interval at z equals plus minus L, and the action of the BF theory or the generalized Young-Mills theory can be written in this function. So this B is an auxiliary field. F is essentially the field strength of the gauge field A, and the restriction of A that essentially can propagate into two dimensions, well, propagate, it's a quasi-topological theory, is we denote it by A1, 2, and essentially this A1, 2, that is the boundary value of the two-dimensional gauge field, is the one that is able to couple essentially to matrix quantum mechanics with the usual minimal coupling or gauging procedure, as we denote here. Now, this is a tripartite system. And since the combined theory is a gauge theory, we have a gauge field, there is essentially a non-perturbative constraint that needs to be satisfied. So if we introduce Wilson lines that extend essentially between the two boundaries, so imagine a Wilson line that extends from the first boundary to the second boundary, we can define something that is called the Young-Mills current, in some sense, through this Wilson line W. And essentially, we find that there is a relation between this Young-Mills current and the two matrix quantum mechanics currents. In the case where there is no Wilson lines, or in the gauge that A is Z equals zero, essentially the two matrix quantum mechanics currents are identified. And this is the usual way how one defines these two currents for matrix quantum mechanics. Okay, so let me try now to explain to you what is the effect that this constraint has. Now, for each matrix quantum mechanics, what we try to do is we start with the matrices M, M1, 2, and we try to diagonalize them by performing unitary rotations. The same also happens for the currents, they get rotated. The Hamiltonian now, when we do this splitting, acquires two pieces. One piece is diagonal in the eigenvalues, lambda I of the matrix M. And there is another piece that couples essentially a two-body force that couples essentially interaction terms, that couples essentially the eigenvalues. And this case are to be thought of as UN targets that have to do with the UN rotations. And this Hamiltonian acts on wave functions that are multiplied by a van der Mode factor, this totally anti-symmetric factor, and they generically transform in the UN representation R. Now, if we had a single matrix quantum mechanics model, a single model, then we would have to impose, instead of that constraint, that J1 equals zero. So imposing that J1 equals zero essentially completely kills this second Calogero type of term. On the other hand, now, since we have a more involved constraint, we essentially find that the representations of the two matrix quantum mechanics are essentially entangled or tied through this constraint. So if we want to understand this further, it is possible to compute the partition function of the system by placing the total system on an interval times a cylinder. So now we imagine that we have this geometry, we compactified tau, and we place in our geometry the interval, this was Z, and this is tau that is now compact. We know explicitly the partition function of 2D Young-Mills on the cylinder, and it takes the following form. So let me explain to you what this form is. So this U1, 2 are asymptotic holonomies of the asymptotic values of the gauge fields on the two boundaries here and there. So this captures the zero modes of this gauge field. These chi r's are characters of un that depend essentially of this on these holonomies, and r is a un representation index, and this c2r and cur are Casimirs of un. Now this can also be thought of as a transition amplitude between two wave functions. The first wave function is chi r of u1 that lives here. The second wave function is chi r of u2 that lives here, and we have a propagation that is described essentially by a heat kernel evolution between these two states. So, okay, this is well known, but that's not the full result, because this should be coupled also to the two matrix quantum mechanics partition functions that also depend on this holonomies U1, 2, and then we need to integrate over the zero modes. So once we do that, the complete partition function on the cylinder is found to take the following form. That is remarkably the same as the form that we described in the beginning that we wanted to have. So we see here that we have again a sum of the representations. These representations are common for the two matrix quantum mechanics models. Beta 1 and beta 2 are the sizes of the two S1s, the two asymptotic S1s. And again, the CR 1,2 are the Casimirs of UN. Now, each ZR of matrix quantum mechanics can be thought of as a trace over the Hilbert space in the representation R using the Hamiltonian that we had before, this Hamiltonian that we described here. Now, now we have an explicit understanding we had this label S that was labeling the different sectors that we had to average, but now we know explicitly what the sectors are. These sectors are essentially representations of UN. So this S of R is a form of averaging that is consistent with unitarity or reflection positivity in the Euclidean setting, but now we have a single quantum mechanical system. We didn't take a collection of systems. We had a single system that we defined, and the partition function of the full system took the form that we wanted. So are there any questions? Okay, so we moved forward and we studied an even more, let's say, complicated model. So we were able essentially to liberate the ranks of the gauge field that propagates in two dimensions and the ranks N1, UN of the matrix quantum mechanics group by introducing some additional bifundamental fields at the boundaries. So again, the partition function took a similar form as a sum of the representations. And the reason why we did this is because we now have additional parameters to tune. We have essentially the ratio of ranks, little n over capital N. Now, as an aside, the analysis is most easily performed using some appropriate polynomials that are called Hall-Littlewood or Kostka polynomials. And what was interesting in that model that we found in addition to the previous model is that when the little n, the rank, let's say, of the Young-Mills group that lives in two dimensions, is much smaller than the rank of the UN of matrix quantum mechanics, then we generically have a very small deformation of two decoupled matrix quantum mechanics systems, as expected. So the dual geometries would be factorized, and there's possibly some very microscopic connection that is not even geometric. And when this little n goes close to capital N, then essentially the leading saddle is very different from that of two independent matrix quantum mechanics. And we go back to the previous model that we described before. We also analyzed some cross correlators, then point, let's say, cross correlator of this model. And we found that essentially it takes this general form. So here, by O's, we denote operators that refer to the matrix quantum mechanics one. And with the label two and the tildes, we denote operators in the second theory. Now, you see again that this correlator is essentially an average over factorized correlators between the two independent theories. And generically, this correlator depends or separately only on differences in time that have to do only with index one or only with indices two. And there is no mixing between one and two indices. Again, cross-communication arises at the leading saddle point level when we take both parameters to infinity. And otherwise, we have an almost factorized contribution. In addition, we were also able to compute some simple two-point cross-correlators when these operators are simple traces of the matrices M1, 2. And in that case, the correlators are simply constants because each one-point function is essentially, there is translation invariance on the circle, so each one-point function is essentially a constant. And this holds for any representation R. Okay, so let me give some remarks about the dual geometry, let's say, of these models. Now, the singlet sector of just a single gauge matrix quantum mechanics is known to be dual to a two-dimensional linear Dilaton background of the C equals one Liouville string. So in that case, there is only one asymptotic region of space. On the other hand, we also know by work by David, Juan Maldacena, and some work with Olga, that if we consider some non-trivial representations with a few number of boxes, then essentially we deform the geometry by the propagation of some long strings. But if we want to deform the geometry macroscopically, we need to consider a large representation limit so that we deform essentially the background geometry. And possibly we can create a black hole or some more interesting geometry. So what we did in the models, now we have two such matrix quantum mechanics. They are in non-trivial representations that are essentially entangled between them. But it is possible again to take a larger representation limit. So we take a limit of continuous tableau. Let me try to describe what I mean by that. So these representations are in one-to-one correspondence, if we want to describe their highest weights, by Jung diagrams, Jung tableaus. So these are labeled essentially by a collection of integers, lambda one, lambda two, that number the boxes here, lambda three, so forth. And there's a limit that one can take where the shape of this tableau becomes a continuous shape, a particular scaling limit. And that's essentially the limit that we wish to take. Now, it is possible to study that. It is technically difficult, and it's actually hard to read off the dual geometry. It is not known how to do the bulk reconstruction essentially in this large representation limit. But what we were able to prove so far is that there are different samples of the effective equations of motion, some of which we expect to correspond to disconnected and others to connected geometries. And it will be very interesting to study phase transitions between them. So we're still working on this problem, and I think it's a very interesting problem to be solved. So, okay, that concludes my discussion about the two-dimensional problem. Let me now move forward to some higher dimensional examples. Of course, as you understand, this construction can be generalized very easily to higher dimensions, because again, we can consider a sandwich spacetime with a topology of the manifold sigma across an interval, and we can place the two holographic FTs at the endpoints of the interval and couple them essentially by a quasi-topological quantum field theory that lives and exists on the full manifold M. For example, in two dimensions, we can consider two-dimensional B quantum field theories, coupled essentially through a Chern-Simons theory that lives in three dimensions. In three dimensions, we can use a 4DB type of axion, and so on and so forth in higher dimensions, because we can use, let's say, five-dimensional Chern-Simons theory or whatnot. So I think that's a promising feature of this construction. And let me give you some a few details on how the 2D, 3D model works. I'm not going to solve it completely, but show you a few details. So when the topology of the manifold is sigma across an interval, it is actually useful to employ radial quantization. So we can pick a gauge where AR is zero. And in that case, the Chern-Simons axion becomes quadratic, and all the nonlinearity is essentially imposed in this equation, because this F is nonlinear in A. Now, since this axion is first order, there are various choices of conjugate pairs that one can take. And essentially, one useful, usually employed quantization is the so-called holomorphic quantization that I described here, the way to quantize this theory. Now, the result, of course, depends on the topology of sigma. So the simplest topology that one can consider is when sigma is two tors, for example. Then there is a natural decomposition of the gauge field into two other fields, one complex function and one complex group-valued vector. In the abelian case, this is just this U1 compact complex function. Now, in that case, we know explicitly the wave functions of the system, either in terms of theta functions in the U1 case or in terms of the so-called Weyl-Katz characters. Now, how do you think of these wave functions? These are essentially the objects that generalize essentially the characters that we had in the 2D BF model. Okay, so we define these wave functions, the transition amplitude of Chern-Simons. In addition, I should mention that for consistency, we should add also some appropriate boundary terms, depending on the choice of the polarization that we made. Then we define this transition amplitude and we couple it to the two boundary QFTs in this way. And this defines, let's say, the total partition function of the system. Of course, again, here now it's very hard essentially to compute, let's say, such objects in an explicit example. But we would like to understand some more supersymmetric examples where localization might be of help to actually compute such objects. Okay, I don't know how much time I have. I can give. Okay, thank you, Olga. So I can give just a small discussion about this part of the talk. We consider also another class of such tripartite models. models of non-interacting massive messengers, where we take two interacting quantum field theories and we cross-couple them through a free, essentially, massive messenger field. You can follow the same steps. I don't want to get much into detail. But again, because these QFTs are separated in an additional dimension, essentially, again, you find that the cross-correlators are sufficiently soft in the UV. And there's some exponential, let's say, softening of such cross-correlators. But okay, I don't want to get into much details about these theories. What is important to say is that there is an issue about reflection positivity when we try to analytically continue such theories in Lorentzian signature. And let me try to explain to you what I mean by that. If you remember, we have this sandwich spacetime. And this is Euclidean, but we can consider two possible analytic continuations. There's one analytic continuation along this direction that we called previously zeta, to make this to try to analytically continue here, or another analytic continuation along this direction tau. And depending on the analytic continuation that we try to employ, the correlators generically can exhibit some issues. And not in all the models are such correlators well-defined. Let me say generically that this is the properties of the analytic continuation. But in some sense, we found a subset of models, that's the important thing, for which this analytic continuation can be made to have sense. And again, it would be interesting to understand what is the analytic continuation from the gravitational side. So from the gravitational side, let me give you some remarks about that. If you remember, if you have this Euclidean wormhole geometry with two boundaries, you can choose again to have two analytic continuations, one along the radial direction and one along the boundary direction. Now, if you do an analytic continuation along the boundary direction, you get something like a traversable wormhole. So this analytic continuation results into a traversable wormhole. If you do the radial analytic continuation, that I think is even more interesting, but it's hard to understand in field theory, essentially you get something that is a Big Bang, Big Crunch universe. You find a cosmology that essentially you have a universe of zero size that expands up to a finite maximum size and then contracts again. And of course, you can imagine that in such a case, you might find some pathologies or the field theories that describe such a system might not obey reflection positivity and so on and so forth. So, okay, this analysis that we did here that I didn't explain in much detail was, let's say, a preliminary step in order to understand the properties of such geometries. But again, okay, we didn't really finish, let's say, this analysis. So there are some potential issues that need to be clarified. So let me now summarize what we did and describe some future directions. So what we did is the following. We studied a variety of Euclidean wormhole solutions, and we computed correlators of both local and non-local observables. We found some common properties that the cross-correlators do not factorize and they are soft in the UV while strong in the infrared. And we have a proposed dual description in terms of a system of interacting quantum field theories. Now, these field theoretic correlators are compatible with geometric dual computations. And we also propose some microscopic models such as the one in terms of two matrix quantum mechanics or big CFTs coupled through a topological messenger theory. And these are there are concrete generalizations also in higher dimensions. What is important about these models is that all these models are unitary and they require no additional averaging, except of the sum over representation that comes naturally, but there is no large deviation from the usual, let's say, holographic prescription. Let me give also a remark about the general structure of the Hilbert space of such theories. So for Lorentzian wormholes, for example, the black hole, the Hilbert space, as we described, is the product of the two Hilbert spaces of the two field theories. But we just consider a particular state, this thermofield double state, that essentially is an entangled state in the energy basis. Now, in the proposed models of Euclidean wormholes in this world, we have the presence of gauge constraints, and the Hilbert space does not factor as anymore. So we can similarly start with the enlarged space, the space here that is described here, where R1, 2 is a product state for two independent representations. And the constraint essentially reduces this Hilbert space into a subspace that does not take a product form structure that I write down here. So we now correlate or entangle representations and not energies as in the thermofield double state in this construction. Is there any question or no? Okay. So let me conclude now with some future directions. We can study the case of multiple boundaries. We can find a method. It is important to find a method to reconstruct the geometry from a microscopic quantum field theory duon in this large representation limit. It is possible to study target space backgrounds using this Liouville-Wurtz perspective, at least in these two-dimensional problems. And as we said, these non-singlet sectors are relevant also for black hole physics. And we would like to understand more if there are connections between these black holes and wormholes. Also, as I tried to describe in a few in this small discussion, it would be interesting to understand the analytic continuation of such geometries and try to describe cosmological spacetimes. And also, it would be very nice to have some top-down construction that is embeddable in critical string theory. And I think a system where this is possible are the Gaiotto-Witten types of systems. And this was already initiated by Van Aramstong and Bachas and Johan Vlavdas. But it might be nice to go to this limit where the theory on the interval is of a topological character. Perhaps this allows more control of these subsystems. And in the end, also would like to understand the microscopic wormhole gas and these alpha parameters, but that's something that we're working and we don't yet have, let's say, some concrete results yet. So thank you very much for your attention.
Panos, for a very interesting talk. Are there questions for Panos?
I have a small question. Can you tell us a little bit more about this continuum limit of representations, please?
Okay, perfect. Let me go here. Yes, here. So, okay, you know that the highest weights are essentially in 1 to 1. Okay. So you know that each representation, you can describe it by a Jung tableau. And there is a correspondence between highest weights and these numbers, L1, L2, L3, and so on and so forth. These are integers that essentially count the number of boxes, right? Now, the tricky part is how do you take this limit where essentially this tableau becomes continuous. So you need to define some appropriately scaled variables. So you define something like, so imagine that you have representations of UN. Oh, I don't know what happened now. Let me try to, okay. For some reason it refuses to write. Anyway. I will try to describe it in words. So you can imagine now that you take a sort of continuous limit where you define some scaled variables, something like x equals I over n, and lambda of x equals lambda of I over n. And then you need to take appropriately a larger limit. And in that limit, this was described in a lot of detail by Douglas and Kazakov and various other people. And in that limit, you find essentially that the Jung tableau acquires, let's say, a continuous shape. Mm-hmm. And the yes?
Yeah, this I understand. My question is, what do you do with these shapes? So you get some shape that depends on the curve.
That's and the then, point.
And then what are you able to compute with this? Can you compute correlations?
Very good. There is a phase transition between the shapes. So as you change the parameters of the model that we had here, let's say this distance L or the sizes of the circles, essentially, you find that different shapes are leading shapes. Now, if you have the shape, essentially you have the density that tells you the shape. And from that shape, you can compute, let's say, the free energy. And okay, we haven't done that, but perhaps also correlators and other observables. Now, the question, the hard question is, to what geometry its shape corresponds to, right? That's the tricky question. Because you can compute, for example, observables that you find that they don't factorize, but you would like also to understand, let's say, the dual geometry. What is the geometry that is giving, essentially, that is dual to that shape? And this I don't know how to do. I think in something similar was done for LLM geometries in the past. But there, yeah, usually you have a lot of, in the models where you can actually understand this better, I think you should have quite a bit of supersymmetry. So you have a handle also in the supergravity, and you know, you can go back and forth and understand.
So this phase transition is third order? Or?
This phase transition, that's a good question. Yes, it's third order, this phase transition. Typically, but we don't have just two saddles. Okay, I would hope that I can write, but typically, now I can write, perfect. So, okay, so let me tell you some phases that we found. There's a phase where there is a cut. Let's call this endpoints of the cut alpha beta. There is a phase where there is saturation near zero, and then there is a non-trivial function. That's usually a phase transition that one finds. But we also found that there exists, depending on the parameters, so there's an effective potential that one needs to minimize. And depending on the shape of the effective potential, you find different types of cuts, of natural cuts. But then there are more, let's say, more complicated examples, such that you might have a cut, then something non-trivial, then again a saturation, and then something non-trivial. So yeah, I don't know what all these phases are. There's an old paper by Kostov and Staudacker, I think, where they were also finding various phases. I can send you the reference. But they also didn't analyze, let's say, the more complicated phases. They just analyzed, let's say, the first phase. So I don't think that people have understood, let's say, such phases in more detail. But
and in LLM, you say you also have this business of this saturation, and is there a physical picture there?
I don't know. Okay, good. There, I don't know what is the limit of continuous representations. Perhaps someone has studied. I'm trying now to remember the literature, but at least there is a connection between, you remember, there are these blobs in phase space.
Yeah.
This is ABS 5. And then you could have, I don't know, like concentric circles. Like that. And these are essentially in correspondence with Jung tableaus, where, you know, you do something like that. And depending on the size of this black region, you might have more boxes here. Depending on the size of the white region, you have, you know, more boxes here, and so on and so forth. So there is a correspondence between essentially geometries and Jung tableau. Now, I don't know if people have studied the limit of continuous Jung tableau and what it means in that context. I'm not sure. Perhaps, I don't know, someone in the audience knows better, but yeah.
And there, if we add such limits of Young tableaus, the saturation is one of these directions of the Young tableaus is saturated by n, right?
Something like, yes, yes.
Well, the symmetric one, no, but the anti-symmetric one, the maximum is n, right?
Yes, yes.
So they would plateau in that line at the bottom, yes. Right? It would plateau at the bottom and then go up.
Yes, 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 that's right.
I see.
But I don't know the interpretation there. So perhaps someone has done that computation, but I don't know.
Okay, that's very interesting. Okay, that will be related to a couple of things that I'm thinking about. Thank you.
Okay, thank you, Pedro.
Are there more questions for Panos? If not, Panos, thank you again for the very interesting talk.
Okay, thank you very much.